Just Not Good Enough with Chaz House on FUBAR Radio.
I would like to welcome Freddie and Harry George, father and son combo, to Just Not Good Enough. Thank you very much. I've known Freddie. I've known you for how long? 12, 15 years or something like that? Possibly.
I think it's
longer.
Even more than that, actually. Yeah. More like 14, yeah. 15 years.
Yeah. And yeah. Harry, I met you at the races, I think, didn't I?
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, in fact, I do remember you you would refuse to give me your tips for the horses. Because you were so good at it, and your dad was saying, oh, bloody hell, you're so good at this. I said, right, come on, I'll give you, you give me the tips and I'll share the winnings with you. But you never bloody did.
No, well, probably not a bad thing given the run I'm on at the moment.
Oh, is it? Oh, right, okay, yeah. Let's hope you get better for next year. Right, so welcome. Freddie, you were an analyst, when we met, at Seymour Pierce, I think it was, which is stockbrokers in the city.
Yeah.
And Harry, you work for Ernst & Young.
I work for Ernst & Young.
Yeah. Yeah. So you're both in financial services, but broadly.
Both in financial services, right.
Which is renowned for some of its cultures not perhaps being the best.
Yeah.
So, let's I'm going to start with you, Freddie. Let's go back all the way, because we've been chatting about this, over the last few weeks about coming up and what we're going to talk about.
Yeah.
And I think you said that you've gone all the way back to reanalyze what's happened in your life. Yeah.
Yeah.
And you just want to just talk us through that a little bit.
Yeah. These occasions, you always self-analyze what you've done and what's happened in your life. And looking back, I had an idyllic childhood, absolutely an idyllic childhood. It was a bit like out of Darling Buds of May. You remember? My dad had...
Do you remember that, Harry?
Yeah.
No. Funny enough.
But my dad had four farms and some very good farms. But he grew fruit and vegetables. He had cows, pigs.
You were in out my way, weren't you? Gloucestershire way.
Yeah, well, Evesham. In Evesham.
Yeah. Because that's a market garden, isn't it? It's a garden of England.
Yes, it was. Yeah. And he used to leave me on the farm as a 5 or 6 year old, and we just used to play around with the gypsy's children, with girls versus boys. We were up in haystacks, we were in sheds, on the back of trailers.
I know you're allowed to say what you like on here, but I don't want to know about the haystacks when you're five. Sorry, go on.
But it was an idyllic childhood. No question about that. I was very, very lucky. My dad would, all the milk would come in sort of churns, the butter would be straight from the farm. There would be, quite often I'd go into the kitchen, there'd be a sort of pig, the side of a pig hanging from the, from the side. So I had an idyllic childhood, but my dad, thinking back, I was sent to a prep school at the age of eight. I was just eight.
Boarding.
So it was a very young age, boarding school. Mm. Must have been at least 2 hours from home. So, and it was a brutal school. My dad sent me there because it got really the best results in the UK. It was a place called Packwood Hall. And so I went there and, it was cold baths, I think, if I remember, for the first 3 years. Regular beatings. I mean, it was really
brutal. From the teachers?
Yeah, from the teachers. From the headmaster mainly, actually. And the food, I was used to a very high standard of food because coming from a farming family.
Yeah.
And the food was dreadful. I can remember queuing up every morning for porridge, which had, it was in a huge big vat. Quite often there'd be lumps in the porridge. And it was made with water. So it was, awful. And I can remember also they used to make powdered scrambled egg and put that on toast and it layer it up. And if you got the bottom one, it was completely sodden. It was inedible. So that was quite a tough upbringing from there. My dad wanted the best education and the school got fantastic results.
They do it for the right motives, don't they?
Yeah,
But I mean, if you look back on boarding schools now, oh, Jesus Christ, the stuff that they got away with.
Yes, chalk and cheese.
Yeah.
It really is. It's totally different. And you didn't see your parents, you'd see them once every 3 weeks. Yeah. So it was very, very tough. So I went through that. And then in between going to Shrewsbury from Packwood Hall, I had an epileptic fit. It was a fit. And Obviously, my parents were very, very worried, and they were worried about
me going
to... Was
this at school?
No, this was at home. Mm-hmm. And I think they put it down to me smoking as a youngster when I was at prep school.
Really?
You know, taking it, and exactly that. And I don't think it was an epileptic fit, but it was definitely a fit. And I was on very, very heavy drugs for 5 years while I was at Shrewsbury, a thing called Epanewton, which completely makes you a zombie. And obviously had an impact on my academic ability. So then I got into... I didn't get the A-level results I wanted, but I still managed to get into Exeter. Exeter University. Yeah, reading economics, and I was also taken off the drugs, the Epanewton, and it was like fantastic experience.
Do you still get the epilepsy now?
No, I don't. I don't think it was epilepsy, but it was definitely a fit.
Yeah, because you see, William, my eldest son,
yeah,
when he was very young, he had something similar to that.
Yeah.
And he wasn't put on any medication whatsoever, and it happened 3 times, I think.
Yeah.
And we were thinking, Jesus Christ, what's all this about? But actually, it's something to do with it. I think we explained to us about the brain maturing and developing. And sometimes you just get these little crossed wires or something.
It could be. Because I can remember, the one thing I can remember is having wires all over my head sort of 3 or 4 times at the Radcliffe Hospital.
That was just at Seymour Pierce, wasn't it?
Yeah, that's right.
That's how they treated you there as
yeah.
well.
So I went to Exeter. And then I became I joined Coopers and Lybrands and did accountancy.
Okay, but can we just pause there? Because I want to turn to Harry.
Yep.
Did you have anything? Were you aware of all of this or not? Are you aware of it?
I'm peripherally aware, but I suppose we've probably never sort of had an in-depth discussion around, particularly, I guess, Dad's childhood and his time at school, and that sort of aspect of things. And obviously, for me, there's obviously an element of thinking about my own childhood.
Yeah, yeah.
And hearing
we're going to come
that.
On to that, actually. Did you do a prep school? Did your father send you to these monstrous places?
No, actually. I think I had a fairly idyllic childhood up to...
Well, you've got to say that.
All the way, really. rather than having
That's
this
good
sort
to,
of... Yeah, rather than having this kind of terrible experience aged 8. No, I think, yeah, in terms of my childhood, no complaints, very lucky... Went to fantastic schools. I did go to boarding school from the age of 13, but I really enjoyed it. I would say it's not necessarily an environment that would suit everyone.
Mm-hmm. Because it's very diplomatic.
Because I think it can be tough. No matter, and it was tough at times. No matter what your disposition is, I think it can be tough. But overall, I had a fantastic time.
Where did you go?
13.
No, where? Sorry.
Oh, where? Tunbridge.
Oh, right. Okay.
In Kent.
Okay. Yeah.
And I had a fantastic time. I enjoyed it in the sense that it was like living with your mates all the time. And you didn't get on 100% of the time, but you got on most of the time. And I had some.
It was interesting. You said about disposition. Yeah. I mean, could you remember anybody at that time that you thought they're not really enjoying this, they're miserable or whatever, or they were on the outside, and then other people that were, so you almost, I wouldn't say you're in two camps at all, but, because I remember when I was at boarding school, I was definitely not in the cool gang, whatever that means, and I found it unbelievably difficult, but I didn't know why at that point. But so did you see any of that?
I think so, yeah. I think there is something about a boys' boarding house where you have people from the ages of, or boys from the age of 13 all the way to 18, that does create a kind of brutal environment in which you have to kind of fight. And,
yeah, you do.
And I remember our housemaster at school described, because the year group I was in, we didn't get on at all well for the first 2 years when we were there. And there was, people being picked on and people being ostracized and through our first couple of years, it happened to almost everyone that there was a month or two where pretty much everyone out of the 12 of us was the one that no one wanted to speak to, no one wanted to spend time with.
Kids are horrible, aren't they?
Exactly, yeah. Yeah. And he kind of described it as putting some, foxes in a bag and then kind of throwing the bag down the stairs. And it's a kind of, a sort of environment that eventually, if you want, what I found was, if you wanted to live in broad harmony with people, you have to be prepared to give, and they have to be prepared to give. There has to be a sort of a common acceptance that, A, you know, we're all in the same boat, so we might as well get on. But also, you're not necessarily going to get on with everyone.
Doesn't that take a certain maturity to do that, though? And if you have got the makings, if you like, of a mental health condition, I'm not going to look at both of you now, but you can't do that, because, one, you're probably not aware that that's the case. You probably haven't sorted out whether you have got a mental health condition or not. And you know, it's quite a mature attitude and approach where at 13 you're saying, right, I've got to get on with these people.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. And I think a lot of it, in my experience, a lot of it, the decent position we ended up in was thanks to intervening from basically staff who could see what was going on and kind of encouraged course corrections along the way to ensure that we were broadly comfortable at the end of the process. But you know, hearing about your education, and I can imagine that there probably wasn't invested, sensitive adults.
They were the bloody perpetrators, for Christ's sake.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, you're saying you got caned by the headmaster. I mean, I had a sexual predator at prep school.
Yeah.
As the headmaster. And then I got bullied myself at boarding school when I was 14, you know. And it does a serious amount of damage to you.
It does. I didn't see that at prep school, but that probably was going on somewhere along the lines.
Well, the number of people who talk about it now, you know, people who are in very senior positions, you know, certainly in the media and so on, and all the programs about, you know, all these teachers who suddenly shot off to South Africa, you know, because they're wanted in this country for some sexual misdemeanors, you know, extraordinary.
Yeah.
So you now work in Ernst & Young.
Yep.
And you started at Coopers & Lybrand, and so basically the same.
Similar sort of backgrounds,
Yeah. So, Freddie, I'm going to ask you the
Mind you, the accountancy exams were much tougher in my day than Paris Day, I'd say. You know, you had to
pass. Of course, I'd agree with that, you know. Yeah. anyway, no, I won't go into that, actually. I'm going to ask you the same question in a minute, Harry, but Freddie, why did you go into financial services? If I can call it that, Coopers & Lybrand, obviously an accounting firm.
I've thought about this, and I think it's coming back from my dad and grandfather, going back all, because I look at myself, and I have very similar interests to my dad, who had very similar interests to his dad.
He was
a farmer, but he loved finance, he loved shares, he loved the politics, he loved, you know, all the things, football, cricket, all the sports. So I have very similar hobbies and interests as my dad. I don't know why that is, but that's happened.
Yeah, and so it was a natural
thing for me to do.
And what about you then, Harry? Because, you know, it is a very different industry sector, if you want to call it, now than it was back in those days, isn't it?
I think that's right. I mean, I primarily started in an accountancy firm because I wasn't 100% sure what I wanted to do, but I was broadly interested in business. I'd spent some time at a fund management firm when I was at university that I found fascinating, and my perception was that accountancy would kind of give me something to do for a few years while also keeping my options open and giving me opportunities down the line.
It's exactly the same answer I gave and I have given over my whole life as to why I chose finance. Because it's true. It's true. It does open up doors, doesn't it?
And the more you get into it, I think the more interesting you find it, and then you're in that world. And
I want to begin to touch on the culture in financial services, because it can be brutal. And I know, Freddie, you worked at Goldman's, didn't you?
I did.
Is renowned for probably burning out. Well, God, you tell me about the culture.
Yeah.
And your experience at it.
Yeah. I mean, I had a lot of experiences. I'll just give you a bit of... I started at Paribas in the 90s, late 80s, 87, just on Big Bang. And I don't think there was... At that time, it was such an exciting time, you know. The analysts were very, very well paid. It was work hard, sleep hard, competitive, you were competing. And I didn't see any sort of depression. But I then moved to Goldman's and a totally different environment, very collegiate environment. And
I see, that's not how I would have thought you'd describe it.
I would say it is. Well, I would say that Paribas was very maverick in style, and a lot of entrepreneurialism within the banking sector. But Goldman's was definitely collegiate. You know, I'd say, you know, everybody got graded. You knew exactly where you were in the with the other analysts, and from a sort of grading perspective. And you obviously wanted to move up the table. If you moved up the table, then you're one closer to managing director level, and also your salary and bonuses will sort of increase to reflect that. But it was a very you're working as a team, but on the other hand, you're competing against your other colleagues, and you felt that very much so.
But that must influence the behaviour.
It does influence the behaviour. It does. It was very...
Get back to basic savagery.
Yeah, it is sort of. I was very lucky throughout, and I have 25, 30 years in the city. The people who worked with me, and this is the most important thing, I trusted completely. They never knifed me in the back, had some great friends. I couldn't say that at Goldman Sachs. And if you have people sort of knifing you, I'd use the word knifing in the back or manipulating, or it can... It does affect your morale and, you know, disposition.
Were you the subject of that?
Well, I had a little bit, yes. I had the person in charge of our team was a US analyst. He was a partner, very famous guy in the city, in global retail terms, a chap called Joe Ellis, who was number one rated analyst for 18 years. So he was a very big guy, and he was well known. If you mention his name in the States, everybody probably even now know him.
A big ego as well, I suspect.
Huge ego, a driver on the Myers-Briggs scale, off the scale. You know, he was incredibly manipulative. He would sort of put people against each other. And
what do you think was his motivation for that?
I think he was driven. He wanted to be the best. He wanted to have the best team. I don't really know. I think it was just, he thought it was his business to a certain extent. I don't really know why he was so, and you'd get calls, and I think I mentioned before that we were doing the podcast, that there was one time I did this note on DIY, and it was a very, very, I thought it was a very good note on the whole
DIY?
European.
What's DIY?
Just do it yourself. The whole.
Oh, right.
European.
Oh, I see. On that sector. I thought we were talking about a company.
No, European DIY. So it had Kingfisher, it had Castorama, France, all the German retailers. And it was sort of comparison. A lot of work went into it. And he just didn't like it. He looked at things slightly differently to how he looked at it in the UK. And he said, well, you know, I want to go through this in a lot more detail. Can you come over and see me? And I thought, well, this is a bit of a pain. I have to go over in about 2 weeks' time. I've got lots of things. New York.
New York, right.
Okay. Manhattan. So he said, no, can you get the flight tonight? I thought, well, can I, what? So that's what I had to do.
You shit yourself.
Not really, because but I did. I went over and he went through it, and I made one or two changes. But I just didn't. One, I was not convinced about the way he looked at companies, and we looked at companies slightly differently in UK and Europe.
What about his behaviour, though? So, I mean, there's the analytical side to it, but the behaviour is, and the interaction with other people.
He wasn't aggressive, so you couldn't say he was a direct bully, but he was very manipulative. And he played, there was two people in the team. We had a team of about 8 or 9 people in the retail sector. And then above that, there were people in corporate finance, quite famous people in corporate finance on the retail side. And there were two of us going for being managing director, which is sort of one level below partnership and a huge, you know,
yeah,
huge increase in salaries. And he put me against the other chap in the team. And it was, I found that quite hard.
Did you talk to him about that? Did you raise it?
With
him?
Joe Ellis.
Yeah, saying, why
no,
have you
not
done
at
this?
All. It just wasn't done, you know. And also, I had a problem. I did get burnout from all this because I was working incredibly long hours. to get a report out, I would be sort of working at weekends on top of working during the week, on top of all the other things that you get. And with Goldman's, you can never be in control of your time. You know, there'll be somebody ringing up from California, can you do this? And if it was a partner, you had to drop everything. That was the culture to do that on top of what else you had to do. So it was
That is a bullying culture, isn't it? Whether they are polite to you and not aggressive, it's still, that is the culture of how that they operate.
It is the culture, absolutely.
So your burnout, what was that like? How did that, talk me through that.
I got it. There was a number of things happening with the family. Nicholas, my second son, was born, and
that's a good thing, isn't it?
No, it's a fantastic thing.
Thank you for smiling, Harry. But he didn't smile, did he?
You know, Goldman's was a culture whereby you'd say, "Oh, I've just got my son's born," and they would expect you to maybe go out for an hour and then you'd be back at work. And I remember we were doing a report on Carphone Warehouse. They just listed. And I was doing that. You know, I was out sort of with Yasmin and the newborn baby, Nicholas, and then I was back at work within about an hour. And I thought, this is just not right. And I was under a lot of pressure to get this report out. They just didn't really understand, you know, the work, the family work-life balance. That was one thing.
Right.
The second thing is, I think it was just the hours I was doing. A bit of background, when I was at Paribas, I did the food retail sector, you know, European, so I covered Carrefour, all the big food retailers, and we had a fantastic franchise. We were probably the number one commission raiser, because Paribas was very close to Carrefour, all the other French retailers, also very close to the Belgian retailers, GIB, Delhaize there, and we had huge commissions from that. I reckon probably 20-30% of the market in both markets. So it was huge. So I had a fantastic franchise when I went from Paribas. But then Goldman said, we want, you know, very bizarrely, we'd like you to switch to the general retailers, you know, do the hardline retailers, which is the DIYers, Boots.
Tesco's, Sainsbury's?
No, I didn't do that. It was done by another chap. So I did that. Actually, it didn't work out too badly in the long term, but it was a crazy decision in the short term because I knew all the top people all over.
So they recruit you for one thing and then put you on something else.
Exactly. Yeah. So I had to work doubly hard to get up to speed on all these things, and so I just got over burnout.
So what? Describe it though. Well, people use that expression quite a lot, don't they?
The two things I would say is I could be tearful at times, and I was in a bit of a hot, you know, in a fuzz quite a lot of the times. And it was quite obvious, I think, when I was at Goldman's, I did have a problem.
Did anybody notice it help you, show any compassion?
No, empathy? Not at all. It just wasn't the sort of place for that. And I did have one reason why I was, which is a bit sad, because I did have, when I moved to Goldman's, there was quite a contingent of Paribas people who were at Goldman's, and no one really looked up to me. But I didn't expect that, to be honest, Chaz. I didn't, you know, it was part of, you know, I was quite an insular sort of person, I think, I have been.
Yeah, but it's no excuse, though, for not looking after you, is it?
I mean,
driving you that far. I mean, the whole culture of driving people that hard is ridiculous. Certainly in this day.
It is. This day and age, I agree. I didn't think anything of it. The other thing was I was very, very well paid. I couldn't complain.
And quite ambitious.
I was at one stage, but it really held me back. It did affect me. My wife said, you know, go and get some sort of advice on this. So eventually I did have an appointment at the Priory.
Huh?
And he went through all my sort of details, 2 hours and blah 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 and all that sort of thing, and he said, you haven't got depression, this is sort of burnout and anxiety, a combination of the two, and it will wear itself out. And then he said, which is quite ironic, he said, I think I was at Shrewsbury with you. I was in the year above. I remember you.
So he didn't bully you, did he?
No.
Shame. Right. You could have got your own back.
Does that
sound familiar, that culture, from where you are? I mean, don't give anyway trade secrets about Ernst & Young, but, you know.
I can understand how that environment can exist, but I would say the environment in which I work in is not as aggressive and hard line as that. And I think there's a few reasons for that. I do think, you know, I think in banking, you know, the product is the money, essentially. Whereas I think in more sort of broad terms, professional services, accounting, the product is the people. You're selling the skills of the people and their kind of knowledge and their experience and that kind of thing. And I also think that the financial rewards are not as great. And that means you get people that are not necessarily as motivated by money. So in my experience, so for example, I'm on annual leave tomorrow.
Oh, good.
We had an urgent...
Oh, we could stay here for a while then.
Exactly.
Excellent.
We had an urgent request come in yesterday from a huge client, but no one has asked me to work tomorrow, even though it would be helpful if I did. And frankly, I wouldn't put up with that if I was asked to work tomorrow.
How would you deal with that then, though? If, say, they did ask you, how would you deal with it?
I would probably give a little. So I would say, you know, I'm happy to do work. I can work a little bit over the weekend or work late, but you know, it's very important that I am on holiday tomorrow. This has been booked for months.
But it's an imposition, though, isn't it? You shouldn't even have to go through that thought process.
I agree. I think it's...
You're struggling a bit because I get how difficult it is to, when somebody demands something of you at work, to say no.
Yeah,
isn't it? You know,
because it's very difficult.
Yeah, it's and if you've got a mental health condition, it's nigh on impossible. Because there isn't a language, there isn't a, it's not a visible condition. You know, if you've got a broken leg and they want you to fly to somewhere, you say, well, I can't, I've got, you know, my leg's in plaster. Then that's easily done. But if you've got something going on inside your head that you're hiding, that makes it really hard. But then the company should never put you in that position in the first place, should they?
I think that's right. I mean, I think it's something that is, even in the time I've been, so I've been working for a, 6.5, nearly 7 years. Over that time, I have seen a shift in how, you know, I suppose anxiety, stress, broadly mental health has been dealt with. And I think one of the issues is some of the people running the business are more of Dad's generation than my generation.
Yeah, yeah.
Therefore have different attitudes. And I mean, one of the interesting dynamics that I've found in work, and I don't know if this aligns with your experience, but what I've often found is the most senior people are often the most reasonable. It's the middle people. So, you know, people that might be 10 years into their career and trying to build something rather than, you know, in the last, let's say, 5 to 10 years of their career and more comfortable with where they are, that are often the most unreasonable.
That's interesting. I wouldn't have said that, actually.
Oh, really?
From my experience. What about you, Freddie?
Yeah, not my experience either. I would say the senior people are, of the firms I've worked for, are very, very driven.
Yeah.
And they don't really care. Well, certainly going back 20, 30 years ago, they're not. It's just not on their radar screen.
No, they're mental awareness. They're driven by business performance.
Yeah.
Mental awareness doesn't register. Yeah. And the behaviour of those people at that senior level washes down the organisation because that's how it works. So I'm surprised to hear you say that it's the middle management that are the worst when the top guys are actually showing them how it should be done, if I put it that way.
Yeah, no, I think it's a fair challenge. I mean, my experience is that the people that I have found have acted most unreasonably are sort of middle managers. And I wonder if there's a perspective issue in that if you are senior in the business and you're managing a team of, let's say, 50 people or 40 people, you'd much rather someone with a problem takes some time out and gets better rather than lose them from the team. Whereas I don't think people in the middle of firms necessarily have that perspective. They're not thinking about the overall business performance. They're thinking far more about, you know, we've got a deliverable to get out by next week. I don't care if you're not well. I don't care if you have to work the weekend. I need it done. Because and it's probably, there's a question about kind of how accountability flows within organisations, because you know, that should never really happen.
Absolutely, it shouldn't happen. I'm still trying to get over the fact that it does.
Yeah, I mean, I would say it's better than it was. I have had some bad experiences with more senior people, and I don't have an issue with being pushed to work hard and to get lots done. What I've found difficult is when I've felt people have been being kind of deliberately nasty. And you know, there's one example. In fact, I think the people that spring to mind no longer work for the business. Partly, I think, by choice and partly not by choice, because I think the issues I sort of brought up were also raised by other people. But there was one example where I moved internally to a new role, and it was my first or second week performing that role. And I was asked to do something. I did my best, and then I came back with a list of questions, and I was told, I'm shocked that you are even asking these questions. You should already know this. I don't understand how you don't know this. And on the face of it,
it's good for your self-esteem, that.
Exactly. Mm. And you're new in a role. You're desperately trying to impress everyone. You don't know anyone. So you don't have those kind of personal relationships that you can fall back on and ask people stuff sort of on the sly, or, I'm not quite sure about this, can you give me a steer? And actually being told that was awful. And I remember going home that evening and thinking, what have I done? Have I made the wrong decision? Am I going to have to resign? Because I can't work in an environment that isn't supportive in that sense.
Did you call that out, or did you call that out? I mean, you said that this issue had been raised, and presumably this is the same person we're talking about. So how did you feel about calling it out if you did?
I felt very apprehensive about doing it at that stage of where I was in my career, having joined a new team recently. What I subsequently found out from chatting to other people at my level was that behaviour was not just targeted at me, but was that individual's behaviour towards a greater number of the team. And I mean, that's something I've learned over the last few years, and you guys have probably learned this as well. Chances are, if you see something that you don't like, you're not the only one that's seen that. Other people will have picked up on that as well. And chances are other people will agree with your view that that's unacceptable. So,
but it's crossing that boundary, isn't it, between you talk amongst yourselves, you know, over a pint or something, and you think, you know, he's a bloody arsehole, that bloke, you know.
Mm.
But it never goes any further than that, because you think, you know, it might be your boss, or it might be your boss's boss or something. And there, you know, you go up the hierarchy, it's going to get to that person, and he'll say, right, you bloody said that about me, did you? You know, so there's a fear of your own financial well-being in a way. Mm. And what about you, Freddie? Would you have called it out at all?
No, definitely not.
No, I wouldn't.
It wouldn't even cross my mind to do that. No.
But a lot of these people, though, don't they? They, you know, you call it out.
Yeah. Right?
And it takes a hell of a lot to do that. And the person says, oh, don't worry about it. It's just his way. Oh, yeah, that's bollocks, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's not just his way. He's being a twat.
Mm.
So people should take you seriously. And I sense that it is being taken more seriously now.
I think it is. I mean, and I think it has to be, because I don't know whether it's a generational thing, but I think people my age just won't put up with it. I've got quite a few friends that have moved jobs in the relatively recent, you know, in the last year or two. And for the majority of them, the reason they've moved jobs is because they found people that worked with, or that the cultures in those businesses were intolerable. And that says a lot.
That's just fantastic.
Because
you will lose people, won't you? I mean, if you have a toxic culture, people will leave.
100%.
And it costs you a hell of a lot of money.
It costs you a fortune, because you lose people with really valuable skills that have built relationships with clients. And that's ultimately...
Then you've got to recruit, train...
Yeah.
Mm. Probably pay more as well, because it's a replacement or something.
Yeah, so I think, and in that sense, that's why I really like the team I'm in, because I genuinely like the senior people, and I would enjoy the job a lot less if I didn't like them as people and enjoy working with them.
Do you think your peer group now looks at organisations in a different way, even if they don't feel that they have to leave, but they're looking at an organisation that they might want to join, that they actually ask about the culture as well, so that becomes important?
100%, yeah. I think, you know, certainly whenever I've, you know, looked at jobs, that's been one of the first things I've looked at. And because of, you have the Glassdoor website where you can read reviews of companies written by their actual employees, and I know, you know, if I've ever looked at a role, I've always checked Glassdoor, and I know my friends do the same. So it is a thing that people look at 100%. I don't know if that's changed, perhaps.
Mm.
Ready?
What do you mean on
looking at culture? Like that would be one of the key things.
Yeah, so the choice that you make for when joining an organization is not just the fact, yeah, it's a big company, it's good, it's got a good brand name, it's profitable, I've got opportunities. It's more saying, well, hold on, how are they going to treat me when I get there?
No, I mean, I've got, you know, when I got offered the job at Goldman's, I had to take it, you know, because of the one, my salary was going up, two, it's a sort of bigger business, bigger opportunity. No one would have really. Some people actually might have taken that into account. And in fact, I have heard people who got offered jobs at Goldman's turned it down because of the culture. But in my case,
quite
I didn't.
Brave, isn't it?
Yeah.
Considering I did. The salaries will be fantastic and the bonuses are fantastic, assuming you do well.
Yeah. But I think it does have a bad reputation. It did, even when I was there, had a bad reputation. Mm.
How about the investment decision, though? And I suppose it's probably more Freddie than you, although you still you're getting involved in some sort of that work. So I mean, I was at a CCLA, I think I said before we came on air that I was at a CCLA seminar, which they're an investment company, house, I suppose. Fund manager, that's the word. And the girl stood up and started to talk about that actually they're now starting to critique the companies that they invest in because of their culture and their mental well-being, looking after people and all of that sort of stuff. And if they're not on the right side of that, then they go into sort of the down the scale in terms of being able to track their investment. And I just wondered the perspective in the city, and it's in your day it would never have been like that, I guess, and whether that's changed, and or actually is it still the profit motive that drives most investment decisions? They want to see the tick boxes, say yep, they're looking after their well-being, but actually I don't care, I want returns.
I think, first and foremost, it is the profits, the prospects, the valuations, the important thing. But I suspect there's a very strong correlation between a happy team and getting the best results. And, you know, we used to do lots of analyst visits. We came and saw Superdry and that sort of thing.
Yes, I remember those days. Thanks, Freddie.
Yeah, that's experience. But I think you get when you go to a company, you get a feel of what the culture is, how everybody is, how happy and confident people are. And that's really important, too, to how you assess the business. I think also how the teams present, how confident they are in the presentations, what the story is. I think that's also very important too. There's sort of secondary things rather than looking at the bland results and the...
Okay, but what about the investor? Because they're global businesses now, aren't they? You know, you can invest absolutely anywhere in the world, broadly. So the guys who are not in the UK, who don't get the opportunity to see them, and they put it into a joint fund or something in Singapore or wherever, they don't give a toss about well-being and mental health, do they? In the companies they invest in, because they probably don't even know who they are, and they're just looking for money.
You'd be surprised. I think, you know, even some of these very big institutions, as you say, in Singapore or New York, they will probably have a team, or they will have analysts looking at all these things will be taken into account indirectly rather than directly. So, because I think if it's an unhappy team, and as you say, a toxic culture, you don't get the best results.
Well, it was Deloitte, isn't it? I mean, it's a classic number of Deloitte saying in their research that there's a 5-to-1 return on the people who look after the well-being of their staff. You know, for every pound you invest, you get 5 back in performance.
Yeah.
You know, and then you think about presenteeism, always on, as it's so called, and absenteeism, and all those sorts of things which come from a mental health position.
Yeah.
So have either of you experienced, not necessarily yourselves, but mental health people at work in your organisations that you know have had a mental health issue, and how did the companies deal with it?
So I can speak a little bit around what I've seen, and in terms of what I've seen is that there seems to be, which I think is very positive, a kind of acceptance that if you are suffering with, you know, stress-related illness, anxiety, basically the best thing, A, for them and for the business, is time off, come back when you're ready, get, you know, some help, and then come back when you're ready. Because the last thing we want to do is lose someone from the team permanently, who's really valuable and knows their stuff and has relationships with clients.
This takes a lot to actually to say, yeah, hold your hand up, though, doesn't it?
Yeah, I think it does. But I think, I hope that the kind of environment is becoming easier. It's becoming more normalised. It's less of a bad word or something to say. I'm struggling a bit. But I think, I don't think it's perfect. I think there's a way to go.
How do we give people permission then? I suppose there's a question to both of you. How do we give people permission to not feel shame and stigma and all of those sorts of things which we currently have? Although I agree with you, Harry, it's getting better. How do we give them permission? How do we create that psychologically safe environment at work?
I mean, we have something called a mental health day. So you can just email resourcing. You don't even have to speak to your manager or who you're working with on a project. You just get in touch with resourcing, who are the kind of people that run projects and that sort of aspect of things, and say, you know, I need a day off for my mental health, and that's normalized, and then they'll speak to whoever needs to be spoken to. So I think that's one sort of tangible way to make, you know, to normalize things and to encourage people to be open. But it's difficult. It's kind of almost changing the attitude to work is maybe putting the cart before the horse. We've got to change the attitude within society alongside changing the attitude within work, because they kind of go hand in hand.
Somebody said on this show actually about having a capitalism 2.0. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the capitalism we've got at the moment is about money, you know, and fine. But actually, it's becoming far more important that it's the people that you look after that become, and that's the judgment on valuations of organisations.
Yeah. Just going back, in my sort of 25, 30 years, there were a lot of people.
You're older than that.
Yeah.
Already.
A little bit, no, but in the city, older than that. But there were definitely a lot of people who suffered from depression and never really got back into the city.
So it sort of chewed them up and spat them out, did it?
Yeah, and that's it. They just disappeared.
Is it like that now?
I mean, one of the problems is you've got all the institutions are really owned by American houses, and they have a much harder feeling towards mental health. I just sense that.
But they've got the same issues that we have, haven't they? About mental health, or probably more so, actually.
Yeah, probably. But it's still, you know, I think some of these American institutions, they haven't changed that much up to, you know, they're probably more awareness, but whether more understanding of mental health, I don't know. But okay. I would, looking back on, I can remember quite a few people who had, even when I was at Perivale, and that was a fantastic time. I mean, the other problem then was everybody was earning a lot of money, doing incredibly well, very exciting environment. You know, there's a lot of temptation and distraction. So I can tell you, I reckon there was about 20% divorce rate at that time. So that did create some sort of levels of depression. Lot of alcoholism. It was very much work, and I didn't see it, but I would say certainly amongst the traders, quite a high percentage of drugs. Yeah. So that had some impact, but certainly, I did 25, 30 years in the city. That's a rarity. There'd be a lot of people who just couldn't continue.
Why do you think that is, Freddie? Because you know you've had the background, a similar background to me,
yeah,
and I've got stuck with fucking depression,
yeah,
right? And you haven't.
How does that work? That's a good question. I just don't understand that is. And I had a lot of trauma in my early life. You know, my mother died at 21. I just don't know. I know when I was at Nabisco, I was at Nabisco before I joined Paribas for 3 years, my ideal job was working in the city, and I wanted to do it, you know, and I took a 50% pay cut and joined Cours de Goodison that got taken over by Paribas. And I just loved the whole environment. And I loved, you know, I was in the office by seven, and I got a buzz even right to the end when I retired, just being in the office at that time.
Do you miss it?
Sorry?
Do you miss it?
I don't miss it because of the punitive hours, but I still enjoy, you know, I still punt around, you know, deal. And so I do miss
I know
that
you
sort
do.
Of culture.
You won't give me any tips either, you bugger.
Probably lose. I mean, I do. Harry's hitting at the moment.
Yeah, so it's interesting to check your spreadsheet on your results, actually. Yeah. But anyway.
That's right.
Yeah. So I can't remember. What were we talking about?
We're talking about, you know, depression, people leaving the city.
Do you notice any of that, Harry, about, you know, people who obviously are struggling? And I put it into the context of well-being initiatives at work, right?
Yeah.
Because sometimes, you know, if you are feeling shit, right, so the point where you can't get out of bed in the morning, which sometimes happens, then the thought of going on a, you know, well-being day with the office mates is the worst possible thing you can do, you know, because it's just not good for you at that time. And have you seen any of that sort of thing going on where people don't, you know, just don't like it, don't want to participate?
Potentially. I mean, I think it's, I would hope, I mean, it's, yeah, I think there's an interesting thing that's gone on while I've been working, which is COVID, actually, one of the impacts that had, I mean, it's had lots of impacts, good and bad, but one of the impacts it had on us as a firm was a lot more effort was made, because everyone was stuck at home, to create groups that would check in on each other. So, you know, during COVID, there was, I think, 40 minutes blocked out every Friday where five of us would just join a call and chat and talk about what we were watching on the telly, what we were having for dinner that night, all of that sort of stuff. And actually, a lot of that and that sort of cultural change, I think, has continued, where, you know, if, for example, if someone just doesn't join a call out of the blue, you know, fine, but someone is likely to say to someone who's in their support group, check in with them, check they're okay, you know, find out if they need any support.
Yeah, that's great. That's really good.
And that's really good. And I didn't see any of that before COVID. I think that is a sort of cultural change that's partly happened because people are working from home more.
Yeah.
So you're not
you need to do that, don't you? Because as well, my son is, unfortunately, the poor son's probably got a little bit of what I've got. And he goes into the office three days a week, right? And you can just sense that lack of human contact is having an effect on him. But you've got the excitement of going into the office. So, you know, I don't know where the right path is here. Is it? You should go into the office because of that human interaction.
Yeah.
Personally, I think that's the right thing to do.
I think I think one day at home is okay. I mean, I think the important thing is, depression, feeling part of a team, feeling, you know, everybody being supportive within that team, I think is for me, would have been the most important thing. And most places I felt part of a team, everybody's helping each other. You know, we're all trying to do as well as we can. Everybody does well. That was the sort of my culture.
Yes, that's interesting, because throughout my career, I can plot where I had a depressive situation, right? Yeah. You know, and sometimes these go on for years, like literally years. And it's related to the team spirit in that organisation. I've never really thought about that before, but I was trying to think about, I didn't like the company, or I didn't like this person or that person. But it's not. It's about, do you feel supported and part of the team?
Yeah.
And if you didn't, that your self-esteem gets shot, you disappear down a well of inadequacy, and you're just not good enough, is that how you think about it? So.
Yeah, I think the bottom line is you've got to choose who you're working with.
Yeah.
You've got to trust them completely, almost with your life. That was my culture, and I was very lucky.
Yeah. Where do you see the future going, Harry, for this? I mean, that's a difficult question, and maybe, you know, an instant response is difficult, because I'm glad I had to ask the question, not having to answer it.
No, I think there's I think there's probably two things that make me quite optimistic, which is, you know, it comes back to the point you made earlier around, you know, investment in staff, in people, will drive a return. It might not be instant and it might not be immediately tangible, but you are going to get negative impacts on your business of people leaving and that kind of thing. The other thing, which is sort of makes me optimistic and also comes back a little bit to your question around, you know, investment decisions and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
You know, toxic work cultures breed governance issues. You know, if you have people that are only motivated by greed, they will do things that is not necessarily in the best interest of the business, but is in their own best interest. And I, you know, I used to do a bit of work involving corporate fraud and that kind of thing. And you can almost guarantee that environments in which, you know, fraud and that sort of behavior is going on have toxic cultures.
That's interesting. Because
people are not being motivated necessarily by in the shareholders' interests or in the owners' interests. They're being pushed to be motivated or incentivized by kind of things that are extraneous to the actual performance of the business.
Yeah, wow, that's really interesting, actually. So, because we had Ruth Davidson, you know, leader of the Conservatives in Scotland, here a couple of weeks ago, and I was asking her about the culture and the, you know, whatever happens at Westminster. And I mean, my God, you know, you only need to look at that from the outside to think, shit, there's no way I'd work in that place. And sure enough, it's because it's all about short-termism. Mm-hmm. You know, we're coming up to an election every 4 years, 5 years, or whatever it is. We potential change of government. So all they do is they slag each other off and say, we've been brilliant, you haven't. And then going around stabbing each other in the back, using your phrase, you know, and it's because of that. It's all about self-interest for a short period of time. And that's sort of what you're talking about, isn't it?
Yeah, I think so. And it's and that kind of short-termism breeds bad behavior. It means that if you have an inclination to a mental health condition, that's going to be exacerbated. And it detracts from the feeling of a team because people aren't pulling in the
same direction. It's corrosive, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. What do we do about it then? How do we get to capitalism 2.0? That's another tricky question. I don't know who I'm asking that. Freddie?
Very tricky question.
I think everybody stumbles on that because it's nigh on impossible to answer it.
Yeah.
But, I think
everybody's got to be a bit more open. I think two things. One is if you have a mental condition, you need to be quiet. You need to accept that you've got one and it needs to be communicated to somebody within the company.
Agree. Yeah.
And then you've got, I think there were people who, I can remember a head of sales at Paribas, she had a mental condition. She got burnout. Part of trying to manage a family and working, trying to get the balance right. And she was away. But I think there has to be a program of trying to get you back on the... It's no good saying, oh, we'll take 2 months off and then come back again or a month off. You've got to... That never happens, you know. Maybe Paribas were very good on those sort of things, actually. But they would have... They didn't, you know, they didn't understand mental.
No, well, nobody did.
Yeah.
But, you know, I always use the analogy of Martin Luther King.
Yeah.
You know, his field of dreams. What was it? I have a dream speech.
I have a dream.
Yeah, not field of dreams, Christ. That moment changed black civil rights, if you like, in America, as in the Rosa Parks bit. Yeah.
Yeah.
And that was in the 60s. And we're now getting to a point where actually black civil rights is sort of... becoming okay. It's still not absolutely everywhere in the world, obviously, but so it takes two or three generations. And if you think about mental health, it's really only it's been less than a generation since this has come out to be an issue. So we've still got, I think, two generations to go before it becomes something that is just accepted. But the motivation, I think, is much faster. I think the ways of communication, the technology that helps is much faster. You know, so I'm positive. I'm positive for the future, I must say.
Yeah.
So what do you two do to look after yourself mentally then?
Well, I'm retired now, so I'm
that doesn't that doesn't matter. Okay. You still need to do it.
I think,
as you know.
I think because I had, going back an inferiority complex with my sort of academic career, I was very careful. I was sort of, I can remember one thing my dad used to say, which is a very keep on the straight and narrow. So I used to, you know, make sure I slept proper hours, keep fit, enjoy all the sort of sports I could do and that sort of thing as a sort of distraction. I really enjoy that. Read a lot, and I still do that, you know, and I think that keeps me sane.
Yeah, it does. Yeah,
I try to eat now as healthily as I can.
Yeah. You're looking bloody well. I know you've been abroad, but you do look really well, actually. Sickeningly so, if I might say so. What about you, Harry? What do you do?
Yes, similar. I mean, one of the things I do is I try not to drink alcohol for more than 3 days in a row because
your dad and I are laughing because that's nigh on impossible in our generation. Yeah. Jesus.
Maybe not on holiday, but I do find myself waking up feeling miserable if alcohol's
a depressive.
Yeah. Mm. And the other thing, I speak to a counsellor sort of semi-regularly.
Do you?
Yeah. Because I had a period about between 2 years ago and 18 months ago when Emily, my girlfriend, and I were buying a house, and I found the process incredibly challenging. You know, not being in control, I struggled with not having a plan, not knowing where we'd be living, and as a result of that, I was probably drinking a lot and more regularly than I should have been, and it sort of came to a head, and I started speaking to a counsellor, and I found the whole process kind of transformative. I was being asked questions like, "How do you feel about the house process?" And I'd never considered how I'd felt. So unsurprisingly, I kind of was taking out my frustrations and my stress and my anxiety, you know, out by being miserable and by drinking too much. Whereas...
It's such a common story, you know.
Yeah. Whereas just being asked to actually, you know, what are your three main feelings about this? And actually having to think, oh, what do I feel about this? Was a kind of transformative process, which it probably shouldn't have been, but it was.
No, but it will be if you get the right counsellor. Because I resisted it for bloody decades, you know, and I eventually went on the Radio 4 Ramblings program with Claire Balding, and she sort of persuaded me and said, "Well, you really should, you know." I said, "No, I don't need to. I'm an accountant. I can deal with this, you know." And I did, and it was transformative is the right word, because you start to realise, and what you just said, Freddie, about if you have a mental health condition, live with it. Don't suffer from it. Live with it. Manage it. Don't control it, because sometimes you can't control it. But recognize it, and, you know, and don't be ashamed of it. You know, it's what you are. It's how you are. And that's what you're sort of getting out of your therapy, is it?
I think so, yeah. And it kind of, you know, it's taught me a lot about how to process emotions and how to describe emotions. Because I think... I don't know whether this is a product of going to boarding school or
it's a man thing.
Yeah. You're not necessarily equipped with the armory to explain how you feel.
There's
about
no language,
things.
Is there?
Yeah.
No.
So actually being sort of being walked through that in a kind of safe environment where you feel comfortable was hugely valuable. And I think you know, I've talked to my mates about this a little bit, and it is remarkable. Of our friendship group of a dozen or so, over half of us have spoken to counsellors in the last couple of years.
That's fantastic. I'm
yeah,
I'm really impressed and pleased with that, actually.
Yeah. And you know, for all sorts of things, but I think and I think it is, you know, that if you're saying, you know, are you optimistic for the future, are things changing, the fact A, that that's happening, and B, that we've chatted about it, is probably evidence that attitudes are
that's
changing.
That is a major step forward. Just talking about it, you know, I mean, when you and I go to the pub, as we do occasionally, you know, it's football, this, super dry, that, you know. But, I mean, do we ever say, oh, how are you, Freddie? Why did I put that voice on? How are you, Freddie? You know, and oh, no, really, how are you? Tell me, you know, we don't do any of that, do we?
Yeah, right. we should do. Definitely.
We should, absolutely. Yeah. You've obviously, therapy's worked well, and the house process worked well because you're getting married.
Yes.
Aren't you?
Yeah.
So, next summer. Congratulations. That's absolutely fantastic. And what a very positive note to finish on. Well done.
Good.
Gents.
Thanks very much.
Freddie,
thank
Harry,
you.
Thanks ever so much for coming in for Just Not Good Enough. I feel a bit better, actually, because of today's conversation.
Good.
Seriously. Thanks. It's done me a lot of good.
Okay.
Me a lot of good.
Good.
Thanks. Cheers, guys. Thank you for tuning in to Just Not Good Enough with me, Chas Howes. As a reminder, you can catch up with all recent shows on FUBARradio.com.